I'm delighted to introduce President Ilves, who was Estonia's president from 2006 to 2016. He'll be in conversation with Tim Bouverie, a historian and author of the Sunday Times bestseller, Appeasing Hitler, Chamberlain, Churchill, and the Road to War. Definitely worth a read. Clearly, Estonia's geographic positioning presents some intense challenges at the moment, which makes their impressive profile as world leaders in digital democracy and cybersecurity all the more interesting. I'm really looking forward to this talk. So without further ado, Tim, President Ilves, over to you guys.
Thank you very much, Saracen Partners, and thank you very much, President Ilves, for being with us this afternoon at Chalk Valley. We've got a lot of subjects we want to discuss and I would like to ask you about, but for those of you, those in our tent who may not be completely familiar with Estonian history in the 20th century, I wonder if you could give a brief thumb and nail sketch of Estonian history and your involvement in it so that we get a sense of how we look at things from the present day.
Okay. Well, Estonia, along with Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Czechoslovakia at the time, and Hungary, all became independent as a result of as a result of World War I. Before, they were all owned by different empires, So since basically World War I, this what we call Central and Eastern Europe has had independent countries. Now, our problem with Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania was that we were occupied by the Soviet Union in 1940-41, and they never left. And then in 1991, we reestablished our independence, and my own role basically was that I was the first post-war ambassador in Washington, and then I was called back, and I was the foreign minister from 96 to 2002, where I led our successful, as it turned out, accession to the European Union and NATO against lots of odds. Maybe we can talk about that later. And then I was in the European Parliament, where I was vice chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And then the liberals, the social democrats, and the conservatives asked me to run for president. I told them I didn't want to, and they said, "You won't win anyway." And then I ended up being president, and then reelected. And so, and since then, I've been an itinerant professor at Stanford and Columbia and in Estonia.
And your parents fled from the second Soviet invasion because the Soviets were pushed out of the Baltic states by Operation Barbarossa in 1941, but then the Red Army came back in 1944, and that's when your parents left Estonia. So you have direct experience of, well, or through your family, of being a refugee and growing up outside your country.
Oh, about 7% of the Estonian population left, so that was, or fled, because they'd gone, I mean, the sort of mass atrocities that we see coming out of Ukraine, I mean, the same things were done in Estonia. I mean, mass deportations, killings, I mean, mass killings, all the kinds of things that we associate with the Ukrainian war today.
Well, I want to spend at least a good third of our discussion discussing Ukraine and the threat posed by a revanchist Russian regime under Vladimir Putin. Could I start by asking you how it feels to be in Estonia at the moment and how it's felt since the full-blown invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, or since 2014 when Putin began his military operations in the Donbass? Does it feel as if you are almost on the front line? Is there a sense of nervousness day to day, or do you become used to it?
Well, some of the nervousness comes from people saying, "Well, aren't you worried?" well, and I mean, we have a city right on the border called Narva, and I guess because of alliteration, there have been countless headlines saying something to the effect of, is Narva next? And so, of course, that heightens a sense of kind of a sense of anxiety, but actually we feel pretty good. A, we're in NATO. Secondly, Estonia has had conscription ever since we reestablished independence with a very strong reserve force, which regularly does exercises, large exercises together with NATO. So we're not that worried, and we have all kinds of modern Western missiles that we can count on. So that, on the other hand, the rhetoric and the kind of the general's sort of revanchist attitude, not just of Vladimir Putin, but of Russia in general today, seems to be, I mean, it's this this anger at not having lost what was an empire, and this is empires have this sort of phantom limb problem. It's not just Russia, but as a former empire, they really want to, they miss their subjects, so.
And you don't miss them?
No, well,
that wasn't a question, that was rhetorical, but what, what is your view of the situation on the ground in Ukraine now? It seems from as far away as Britain that after some astonishing successes, Ukraine might actually now be losing the war at the moment. Is that your assessment?
Well, you know, I would say that 6 weeks ago I would have said they're losing because they were not getting the amount of assistance they needed, and now then the U.S. Congress changed its, managed to give assistance that had been delayed for 6 months, which before they changed their mind or actually voted do it, the Ukrainians were having to ration artillery, for example, saying, well, we can't do more than one, you know, per hour or something silly like that they were forced to do. And secondly, the other thing that I think is actually criminal is that both Germany and the United States would not allow them to fire into Russia when Russia, right across the border, was shooting into Ukraine, because, well, they would not allow their artillery, their missiles, to be used against those who were shooting at them, which I think everyone considers utterly ridiculous. And now with the United States and Germany, at least to a limited degree, allowing them to fire back at the people shooting at them from across the border, now they seem to be sort of the Kharkiv offensive of the past several months seems to be a failure for Russia.
But we might discuss the level of aid, military aid, material being given by the West, but suppose it was limitless, or suppose it was going to continue for the foreseeable future, is material enough? We're talking about, at some stage, Ukraine is going to run out of fighting soldiers and people.
Yes, well, that's the problem. If a country three times larger than you is fighting a war of attrition, and the only thing the Ukrainians have going for them is that they have a pretty decent military, and they are fighting a country that is using what they call meat waves. I mean, they just throw people out there, untrained, badly armed, to just do human waves of attacks, which the word decimate would not be appropriate, since the Roman practice was to kill every tenth, and we're seeing sort of a casualty rates of 80% of units being destroyed from the Russian side. So, I mean, that may perhaps evens it out, if it could be really crude, but yes, the problem is they don't have enough people to keep this up.
And you think that NATO should at least fulfill non-frontline roles, in Ukraine as a way of trying to solve that problem?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, this was proposed by Emmanuel Macron, and it has also been supported by my prime minister, who may any minute become the high representative of foreign security policy for the European Union, but we'll see. And several other countries. Now, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you're not going to be in a combat role, but you're doing, say, logistical support, why not? I mean, that's perfectly reasonable to my mind.
You've been very critical of Western attitudes or lack of engagement with the warnings that Estonia and the other Baltic states and Poland have made, and Ukraine, about Vladimir Putin's Russia for a long time. Do you think that there was a moment at which Putin could have been deterred, and what would that deterrence have looked like?
Well, I would say probably 2008, when he invaded Georgia, which was the first indication that the Russians were giving up on the post-war, meaning World War II, the post-war settlement of not using aggression to change borders. And they attacked, and the response of the West was very weak, and in fact, the West then decided that they wouldn't arm Georgia anymore because, well, for whatever reason. We saw it again in 2014 when most blatantly Russia annexed Crimea. I mean, this is a complete and utter negation of everything that came out of the UN Charter and the basis of peace for relative peace, especially in Europe, since 1945. And again, Obama forbade sending weapons to Ukraine. Other countries did nothing. We saw a year after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014, Germany signed the Nord Stream 2 agreement. Think of a signal to send. I mean, basically, Russia said, it's okay, we can invade. And certainly that was sufficient motivation in February of 2022 to say, well, they're not really good. Okay, well, they'll get some sanctions, but we'll get the territory.
The great deterrence example, or what if, which people keep going back to, of the 30s and the rise of Hitler, Munich appeasement. But the crucial difference between then and now, and then since 1945, is the advent of nuclear weapons. And you have been very critical about different Western attitudes towards the threat that Iran has posed, and what Iran sending drones to Israel. But Iran yet doesn't have nuclear weapons, which might explain a difference of attitude. How should the West treat the nuclear threat from Russia?
Well, I'll take it from a slightly different angle. I mean, Russian disinformation has had for 50, 60 years this concept of reflexive control, which is you will say things that will get your opponent to act in a way you would like them to act. And this is exhibited perfectly with Russia's nuclear threats, which, as Russia says, well, now we have this red line. If you cross it, we're going to have to do something nuclear. And then, of course, the West says, oh, no, we can't do that. We'll have to. I mean, that's a perfect example of reflexive control, because you have gotten the Biden administration, the Scholz government, to say, no, we can't do anything because this might cause a nuclear war, when, in fact, all you have to do is say you're going to do something, and everyone stands back, and that's where we are today. At the same time, you see that everything that has been considered, or the Russians have said, is a red line, every time the West crosses it, the result is nothing. Nothing happens. And clearly, if you think it through, you go, well, why would Russia want to, especially if you're a Putin, why would you want to lose your massive estates and mansions and all those things that would be an inevitable result of a nuclear exchange? So I don't really, I think we're just allowing ourselves, I mean, well, I guess the term would be self-deterrence. We are deterring ourselves voluntarily, saying we can't do this, we can't do that, but you see, okay, you got the attackums and nothing happened, you got tanks from the US or from Germany, nothing happened, all those things took place and there was no change.
You've used the phrase self-deterrence, which implies that Western states are frightened of Putin and frightened of what he may do. And yet you also seem to think, and I'm not saying that these things are incompatible, but it is a paradox, that the West is still underestimating the danger posed by Russia and the danger that would accrue from a successful outcome in the war in Ukraine for Putin. How does that paradox...
Well, a successful... I mean, Russian success in Ukraine, first of all, would put Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania against, I mean, bordering Russia. Then there is, I mean, well, if it worked, it worked for Russia to invasion is successful, annexation is successful, well, why not continue? And of course, the larger implications, that basically we have ended the post-World War II settlement. It no longer, the idea that you don't invade a country in order for gaining territory, which has been forbidden since 1945, and which has been cause for, say, the first Iraqi war, when in fact even the Soviet Union said, yes, Iraq is violated by invading Kuwait, it has violated the UN charter, therefore we can go in. All that is off the boards, and we are back to a might makes right world that we have not had since 45. You know, we're back to the Thucydides' aphorism on the Melian dialogues when the Athenians invaded this island and basically killed everyone, even though the islanders of Melos said, you know, you're violating this rule, you're violating that law. And Thucydides summed it up by saying, well, the strong do what they will and the weak do what they must. And that's the world we're back to. We're back to a pre-World War II world and pre-World War II order. So, I mean, if we want to maintain the post-war settlement, then we cannot allow Russia to succeed.
The post-war security settlement has been underpinned by NATO, and NATO has been underpinned by the United States. How worried are you about the possibility of a second Trump presidency?
Well, if we follow what Donald Trump has said, then we should be kind of worried. I mean, he said that if you're not paying enough, I'm going to tell Russia to do what the hell they want. I mean, that's one quote. He has said he would settle Ukraine in one day by sitting down and talking to Putin. Well, I mean, this is talking over the heads of the victims, right? I mean, what do we do with these little Ukrainians there? And I mean, you can imagine Donald Trump having discussion with Putin. I don't think the outcome would be something the Western liberal democratic world would be very happy about.
Aside from, there's absolutely nothing amusing about this whole situation in Ukraine, but there is an extraordinary irony of which, if you look at your career as a Cold War warrior in the 1980s, dispensing pro-Western propaganda from Germany towards into the Soviet bloc, you will readily recognize, which is that the far right in Europe and the far right in America, these people who were the ultimate Cold War warriors, the ultimate exponents not only of containment but of defeating what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire, they are now not just apologists for Putin, but admirers. I mean, you must find this completely extraordinary.
Well, I mean, there is a different generation of people who call themselves right wing. I mean, so I think that people who were, say, continuing the old Republican tradition in the United States, John McCain, for example, died, and there's no one left to pursue that, or they're not of his stature. Whereas what we would call sort of right wing in the United States today is not based on an ideological opposition to imperialism and communism, but rather to finding commonality in identity politics. Russia is a Christian nation, which is utter nonsense, but in any way, Russia, they are anti-gay. I mean, so the identity politics comes into play there. So, I mean, yes, Putin is very anti-gay, and so the sort of the American Republican Party sort of platform is anti-gay. So you get, I mean, that is where the appeal is, and it's not based on the old tenets of individual liberty, rights, and freedoms that was advanced by the Republican Party through Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr.
A consistent line of the far right and the far left, and it's only just been repeated by Nigel Farage in our general election campaign, is that the West is somehow responsible for provoking Putin with the expansion of NATO to Eastern Europe, which you led your country into, and the expansion of the European Union. I presume you don't have see any credence in that argument.
The West didn't go in. We wanted in. I mean, we wanted to be part of the alliance, and we wanted to be part of the European Union, and in fact, the alliance was fairly reticent about letting in these countries in the beginning, and then we had to do a lot of work to convince them that we were up to snuff and qualified to join. So, I mean, this idea that we had no agency and the agency resided in kind of in the alliance is bizarre.
Given the state of Western democratic governments' responses to Ukraine, which you've accused of being tepid, or it's dilatory, it's certainly delayed, and it's quite on-off as domestic battles are fought and domestic constituencies have to be appeased. How confident are you that if one of the Baltic states was invaded by Russia, that Article 5 of NATO, an attack on one is an attack on all, would be invoked?
Well, if it's not, then that's the end of NATO. NATO would not survive a failure to act upon Article 5. I mean, that's just so. That is, would be in the interest of every country in NATO that it all felt vulnerable to invoke Article 5. So we have lots of little countries that would say, uh-oh. No, so that would be the end of NATO. NATO exists on it being a credible organization that will act upon threats to the existence of NATO members. When that goes away, then NATO goes away. There's no way you can resurrect a North Atlantic Treaty Organization once it has failed just once.
Well, that would be the consequence, but do you think it's likely? How confident are you that that NATO is fit for purpose at the moment and that the leaders behind NATO are determined to use the full threat of their deterrence?
Well, of course, I don't know, I mean, to be honest. But on the other hand, I don't think any leader in Europe would want to risk that because that, okay, if I don't support NATO now, what happens next time? So, I mean, it's game theory, right? But I mean, that's where we are. I mean, we don't know what will happen, but the odds are that leaders will not risk losing their own security by vetoing someone else's.
The two dominant leaders in Europe, Macron and Scholz, seem at best, the politest term could be inconsistent. There is one step forward, maybe one step sideways, two steps back. It's very hard to know quite how they would respond or respond if the situation in Ukraine deteriorated greatly, if there was a Russian breakthrough in the Donbass. What is your assessment of France and Germany's attitude to this, to the Russian threat?
Well, I think Emmanuel Macron has been fairly mercurial in his approach, which was as changed dramatically. I mean, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, saying we need to work with China to somehow against Russia. Then another year he said well, Russia's a Christian nation, we have to sort of work with Russia against China. His approach to Russia the first year after the invasion in 2022 was we must not humiliate Russia. These East European warmongers shouldn't be talking the way they are. And then last year, in a speech in Bratislava, Slovakia, he was suddenly very different, saying we should have listened to what the Central and Eastern Europeans were saying. So, who knows? I mean, when it comes to Scholz, it seems that he's part of the kind of the managerial class. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not really political. I mean, he wants to make sure that he gets back into power, and let's not do anything to risk that. And that certainly seems to be behind the approach that Germany has taken to, you know, to the Taurus missile, before that with tanks, where sending tanks, for example, was contingent upon Joe Biden saying we'll send American tanks. I mean, that doesn't seem that there's much leadership there.
Opinion polls suggest that while people in Britain and in the Nordic countries overwhelmingly support arming the Ukrainians and seeing the Ukrainian war through to what they would consider a successful outcome. And obviously the same sentiment would be even stronger in Eastern Europe. But in France, Spain, Germany, and Italy, all recent polls suggest that at least half of the population favor a negotiated settlement now, which would require Ukraine to cede a large part of its territory. How can Ukraine, or how can Eastern Europe, who share Ukraine's concerns at least, counter this drift in opinion? Is the propaganda war being lost?
Well, I mean, we must have... I think Meloni, for example, gets it in Italy, that basically once we allow aggression to be... Once we allow aggression as a successful form of foreign policy, well, then all bets are off. How are you going to say to the next time someone does something that you can't do that? It means that basically we're back to a kind of a Hobbesian pre-World War II world. And I don't think that, right now, Spain and Italy are not confronted with those kinds of threats. But smart people in those countries think about, well, it's not only this thing. Maybe next time we are the ones under threat.
I think probably more than any time in our history, democratic domestic politics is going to have and is having a greater effect on foreign affairs and international affairs than ever before. How people vote in Pennsylvania in November could determine whether Ukraine remains a sovereign nation or not. And that's a very unusual phenomenon. It's also particularly difficult, as you have written about and know, because of the rise of populism and the inability to get certain complex or nuanced messages through. What is your view both on the rise of populism in the West and how it should be countered?
Well, I mean, we see what we saw in the 1930s sort of repeated, in a kind of strong isolationist tendency. And we see the rise of identity politics in a way that we have not seen before, and frankly, we have not been very successful in countering it. So I don't have any prescriptions. I mean, maybe you should get invaded by the Russians, because certainly our response is, the countries of Central and Eastern Europe has been to reject that kind of approach. Well, with the exception of Hungary, probably, but I mean, basically, you have to go through it to understand what you are for and what you were against. Certainly my own country has been kind of one of the most liberal countries anywhere, precisely because of what we went through 80 years ago, but certainly that has carried on. And the reform impulses in my country have been very strong precisely of our experience in World War II. I would not want people to be invaded by Russia, but I'm saying I think it's that extreme that you have to live it to understand how important democracy, liberal democracy, respect for rights and freedoms is. And if you kind of blithely give it up.
But you didn't have to live it. The Americans did not have to live with invasion to realize that the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan were essential elements of combating the Soviet Union and develop the whole policy of containment. That obviously was born out of a war which led people into an internationalist world as opposed to an isolationist world. But what is it that is said to you as countries, as politicians from these countries, when you go to the German Chancellor or you go to the French President or you speak to members of Congress and you say you are underestimating the threat from Russia, you have to support Ukraine, you have to increase your spending on NATO, what do they say to you? Do they accuse you of being alarmist?
Well, alarmist and you are Russophobic, you don't understand. I mean, in the case of Germany, I mean, we're dealing with a strong mercantile impulse. I mean, if you can sign the Nord Stream 2 contract after a year after Ukraine has been invaded, you realize that having cheap energy is more important than the principles you say you support, and that was certainly the case with Nord Stream 2 being signed. When you justify Nord Stream 2, as the President of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, did in 2021, saying, well, because the Germans did such bad things to the Russians in World War II, we have to give the Russians Nord Stream 2. When it turns out that, well, the killing fields of World War II were not in Russia, they were in Poland and in Ukraine, purposefully ignoring that, shows that you're searching for justifications that are not based in fact.
Looking at a specific example of an institution in which you've had a lot of experience, would the West be stronger? Would the West have a stronger moral purpose? Would Europe and the EU have a stronger moral purpose if it took a harder line towards states which are consistently breaking the rules of membership, like Hungary is, Viktor Orban's Hungary?
Oh, very much so. The question is, what are the mechanisms to do that? And so I think there are a lot of smart lawyers looking for those mechanisms, and some of them exist. Clearly, the approach taken by Orban goes against virtually all of the principles of the European Union and liberal democracy, and he's not shy about his position, and constantly saying that, you know, this liberal democratic stuff is wrong. I mean, he said many 4 or 5 years already ago that he does not support liberal democracy. So, I mean, that's a quote. And I think that this is a serious problem, but there are no mechanisms for really ejecting someone. And so far, the European Union has been also afraid to invoke a paragraph of the treaty that was invoked in the case of Austria and the election of Haider 24 years ago, which would restrict their voting rights. And I mean, that shows how far we've regressed, I guess, in that today we're not unwilling to invoke that paragraph, while we were ready to do it with the fairly mild Georg Haider in 2001 or 2002 or so.
So you would agree it's not just legal difficulties and the mechanisms of expulsion or censure. There is a lack of will. There's been a lack of leadership, and the EU is suffering from it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have a lack of leaders. As I said, many of the people who are heads of state and government in Europe seem to be better managers than leaders. Not much in the way of genuine leadership that we've seen in earlier decades.
Turning to slightly more positive subjects, many people in this tent they may know, but some may not know, that Estonia is by far and away the most successful of the former Soviet satellite states. You've been there from the beginning of Estonia's second independence in 1991. Can you tell us how is it, and tell us some of the metrics by which this is measured?
Well, I mean, I think you talk about the mechanism that our people don't want to go through that again. But I mean, when you look at, well, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, we're up there, the top five or six in the world. Corruption, we're less corrupt than most countries in the European Union. We're the only post-commie country to actually have to make gay marriage legal. I don't know, I mean, those are kind of, they are signs of what we are like as a country, as opposed to many other countries. I mean, there is this, has been this view that, well, the post-communist world is this and that. But in fact, when you have more freedom of the press and less corrupt than most of Europe, you go, well, maybe those prejudices are precisely that, prejudices. And so I'm actually quite proud of my country as being one of those countries that actually fulfilled this kind of end of history optimism of the early 90s, that we in fact did overcome those things. It wasn't always easy, but we did a pretty good job.
And was part of this to do with a conscious decision that you were going to try and follow a Nordic model as opposed to, because a lot of the things you've talked about, corruption, and certainly attitudes towards homosexuality and things, authoritarianism, these have come back in parts of Eastern Europe, most notably in Poland until...
I would say, yeah, but it's not only Eastern Europe. I mean, it's kind of... I mean, yes, there is that problem in Hungary and was in Poland. Poland is sort of reversing that. On the other hand, well, authoritarian tendencies are visible in much of Europe, and whether you see a number of countries where populist authoritarians are on the cusp of being elected. You're going to see elections, parliamentary elections in France soon, where between the communists and Le Pen, that they've got about 60% of the vote. I mean, that, I don't know, I don't think they would be able to form a coalition, you never know, but I mean, that says that an overwhelming majority of people in France support things that we would not consider a liberal democracy.
A central element of your impact upon your country has been technology and the way you have championed technology. And Estonia is a leading hub of technology in Europe. Could you tell us how you came from America in the early 90s and how you galvanized support around this idea of this being a generator of economic growth?
Well, I mean, we were really miserable. I was the ambassador in Washington, and we wouldn't get paid, and money would not, because we were so poor. And we were poor, in 1938, the last full year before World War II, Estonia and Finland, well, Estonia had a slightly higher GDP per capita than Finland, which I actually discovered reading the Cambridge Economic History of Europe. In 1992, the first full year of Estonian independence, Finland had a GDP per capita of 24,000 US dollars nominal, and we had a GDP per capita of 2,800. So more than eight times larger GDP per capita. And you look at it and go, well, how are you going to get out of this? So this is a problem we were all grappling with, but my advantage is I had been a geek, and I had learned a program in 1971, like 53 years ago, anyway. So I discovered this thing called Mosaic, which was the first web browser ever, because the hypertext transfer protocol, HTTP, which you see whenever you go on the web, had been invented, but it was utterly useless because you just get this long alphanumeric string, and then suddenly you had this thing called a web browser, which back then you didn't download it, you had to go buy it for $29.95 with 7 floppy disks, and you upload it, and that's what I did. And I looked at this, I said, wow, here is the World Wide Web. Not only is it here, but this is the only, this is one place where we are not behind anyone else if we do it now. We need to digitize, and then I propose we digitize all the schools, which by 1998, all Estonian schools were online with computer labs and connected, and that was kind of the basis of the people who today, all very rich, unlike me, but they all went to school. And when in 2016, when my last year, I would go around and ask his president, I would ask all of these startups, well, how'd you get started? And they go, oh, I was a kid in your program 20 years ago. I was like, oh, great. So now we have 10 unicorns in my country, so one for every 130,000 people. I mean, that's $1 billion company for every 130. No one even comes close. I mean, I think Israel's next, about one for 800,000 people. So we have all these, just a place for tech companies. And we're doing rather well. And in terms of digitization, we remain the most digitized country in the European Union today.
Just before we enter the question stage, reverting to the big theme of what's happening in Eastern Europe and the war in Ukraine, how does this end? Obviously, we're at a tipping point and nobody can tell what is going to happen in the general election in the United States in November. But even with a Democratic president who is supportive of Zelensky and the Ukrainians, it's not been enough. It's not been fast enough. There has been a huge hold up with the Republican Congress. But if we know one thing from history, we know that the Russians are prepared to wait a very long time, and they really don't care about the body count like we do in the West. This sending troops forward, which Putin said is exactly what Stalin was prepared to do between 1941 and 1945, they're prepared to wait for a very, very long time until the West decides this is too expensive, this is too inconvenient. Given that, how do you see this? Are you more optimistic or more pessimistic about the end result?
Well, very much depends on the United States election, but not only for Ukraine. I mean, we actually have to think, say, in terms of NATO, you guys are still there, right? What are we going to do if the United States decides we're not going to be, we're going to pull out of NATO? I mean, how are we going to guarantee the security of Europe? So it's not simply Ukraine, though Ukraine is a, could possibly be a harbinger of a nasty future, but a NATO without the United States? These are things we should be quite concerned about. Not think only about the US election as a matter of what will happen to Ukraine, but what will happen to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which will be 75 years in next week, while there's a summit. We may find all of ourselves in a very difficult position, having really woken up to the how little we have done since the end of the Cold War. I mean, we had this peace dividend. We all decided, well, you all decided, we're the second highest defense expenditure in NATO today, after Poland and ahead of the United States. So, I mean, in terms of percentage, right? Everything's percentage for Estonia. But in any case, we really take it seriously. But all of these countries that have not yet even gotten to the 2% that was agreed upon 15 years ago, what's going to happen? And we have let our armies dissipate. We don't have the troops that we used to have. We've let the materiel sort of just rot away. So we're not in a great position to defend ourselves if the United States goes away. All of us are in deep doo-doo, to be polite about it.
Well, on that technical term, we will open the discussion up to questions. If you put your hand up, there are some roving microphones. There's a huge committee of questions over here. So I can't pick one of them, but if you choose one, somebody with their hand up.
Oh, thanks. First off, Thomas, I think you're rich in non-monetary terms, and that's pretty obvious. Secondly, I think that the blueprint that you showed of how you've taken your country forward is amazing and inspiring. But if you could think about and perhaps present how that could be delivered for the Russian people, how they could move on from authoritarian leadership despite the much bigger population, much bigger land mass, and the challenges that presents. Do you split it up, or what do you think the sort of post-Putin landscape looks like?
Well, given that, even the unofficial polls show there's overwhelming support for Putin and the war in Ukraine, it's kind of worrisome. If your sort of national pride is based on the ability to invade others, that's kind of a serious problem, and I don't know how to resolve that. Democracy was attempted in Russia after the end of the Cold War, but it really didn't take root, and it seemed that there was much more support for a strong hand, as it were. So. I wish I knew.
There's a gentleman here in the purple jersey.
I'd be interested to know what light you could shed on Russia's capability and practice in abusing the internet. It seems to me that your history of monitoring their performance would suit you to answer possibly the question. When we have things like the disruption of our health service taking place, and nobody says whether they believe this is Russia, or how they could stop it, or whether they have any approaches to dissuading Russia by making problems for them, the existence of the internet offers great scope for interfering in other states. But we don't talk about it, and we don't acknowledge its effect on us, and we don't pretend, seemingly, to have any approach to dissuading them.
Well, I would say, first of all, when it comes to the use of the internet, there are two kinds of things that they've done, and one of them is actually hacking and disruption to the actual process, be it sort of attacking the NHS here, or malware, or ransomware. And the other issue is sort of the higher level, which would be disinformation. There have been attempts. The West has countered the hacking and the disruption, malware, with sanctions. But of course, the perpetrators are all in Russia, so there's not much you can do there. On the disinformation side, well, that's something we've woken up to in the past 8 years. You have a report that has not been released to this day in the parliament here on Russian influence in the Brexit referendum, so I don't know what it says. you can ask. So I mean, it's quite, what I would say more broadly, if you just take, it's not only the internet. I mean, there is this unwillingness on the part of Western countries to actually address the full range of what we could say hybrid or gray zone warfare. I mean, in the last couple of months, we've seen murders, we've seen sabotage, various, I mean, we had just a guy arrested in, one guy arrested in Germany for sabotage. We had another guy, well, the Russians did blow up a factory a couple of years ago in the Czech Republic. They arrested another one who was from Argentina who'd been hired by the Russian special services. And the awareness of all of your agencies is quite high. The problem is a willingness at the political leadership level to do something. Why is it that, because in fact, if you admit that there is this case of sort of low-level warfare being directed against the West with proof, but you don't do anything, then you're basically inviting it for it, you're inviting them to continue. And the absence of will when it comes to countering these things, which now, I mean, you can no longer deny that these are not single isolated events. It's happening across the continent. You have murders in Spain, murders in Germany. You have explosions, and you have people beating up Ukrainians. I mean, when you look at the whole range of activities, there is a low-grade hostile action going on against the West by a country that has said, we want to dethrone the West, or whose leaders have said that. So, I mean, it's up to the political leaderships here in Europe to do something. That's why we have these, NATO, the European Union, but they have been loath to address these issues.
There's a gentleman right at the back in a blue shirt, a blue jacket.
Thank you very much, both of you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Ukraine voluntarily surrendered its nuclear deterrent on the breakup of the Soviet Union. And if I'm right about that, do you think that has had a material effect on geopolitical troubles in Eastern Europe since then?
Well, the Budapest Memorandum of 1993, Ukraine gave up the nuclear weapons that were, they had the third largest nuclear armory, I guess, in the world, but they did not have control over it. So, the control over those nuclear weapons remained in Moscow. The U.S., the United Kingdom, and Russia signed an agreement called the Budapest Memorandum by which Ukraine relinquished these. They also, and what is often forgotten, gave up all of their bombers and their missiles, all to Russia. Some of these bombers and missiles are being used today by Russia against Ukraine. The Budapest Agreement had these nebulous assurances that the UK, US, and Russia would guarantee the territorial integrity of Ukraine, which they clearly have not done. And under the Obama administration, after 2014, when Crimea, part of Ukraine, was annexed by the Russians, the Obama administration even forbade arming Ukraine. So we haven't really in the West lived up to what was promised to them, and that's part of the problem that the poor country faces today.
We have time for one more question. I've not been deliberately choosing just men, but I haven't yet seen a woman with her hand up. Is that one? No, I can't see. There's a hand. I don't know who it's attached to at the very back.
I will Is that on? Just one question for you, President. You've talked already about Russian influence and political leadership. Clearly, that political leadership can only be informed by the people. How did you, as president, and perhaps what lessons can we learn from the borderlands in protecting our people from malign Russian influence to help our political leadership?
Well, I mean, I think all of our countries, the three Baltic countries, have actually put a lot of effort into countering disinformation already for a number of years, I might say about 10, if not more, because we were the first victims of it. So that, in fact, is something which I think other countries woke up to only later, in the aftermath, I would say, of the US elections of 2016, the Brexit referendum, when other countries began to wake up. So that's one thing. Secondly, we are really good at catching Russian spies, so that more than almost anyone else, as for a very small country, it's absurd for us to have caught some 11 spies and convicted them, which if you look at other countries, you have countries, you know, 80 times larger than we are that have not caught that many spies. I mean, it's not that they don't, their services don't know they're spies, they just don't want to sort of publicize it. And why is it that you don't want to publicize it? Well, that's a question for your political leaderships. But we have made no secret of the fact that we have caught these spies and we tried them and put them in jail.
If you didn't get a chance to ask President Ilves a question, you have a second chance later on, because at 8:30 there will be a screening, a preview of a film made about a fly on the wall documentary made about the president's time.
About, not by. I didn't have any. I was
no, about the president's, which will be shown in the stove tent, and there will be general Q&A, so, and that's a free event. So anyone who wants to hear more and wants to ask the president's question has an opportunity then. But in the meantime, President Ilves, thank you very much for coming and speaking to us.
Thank you.